Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and once again, it's my privilege to present to you Christopher Simpson, the author of The Science of Coercion, subtitled Communication Research in Psychological Warfare 1945 to 1960, published in hard and soft cover by the Oxford University Press. Chris, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
We've been discussing what literally could be called a networking of social scientists and national security institutions and personages, which had its development with World War II, development during World War II, and then evolved in the post-World War II period to effect what perhaps might be called a synthesis of social science and national security operations. You discuss an old boy network stemming from World War II that we touched on in the first half hour of our interview, and then you trace the concretization, to coin a term, of this relationship between psychological warfare and communication research with the development of the post-World War II national security state through such NSC documents as NSC directives as NSC 4, 4A, and 10/2. Could you briefly discuss those for us?
Sure. NSC, of course, is the National Security Council, and they're the principal advisors to the president on national security issues. That got set up mainly because up until the end of the Roosevelt administration, you had the military advisors kind of shouting in one corner and the political advisors shouting in the other, and the President Roosevelt was crafty enough to handle both, but as a new world emerged, Truman and his successors wanted a staff to combine the military and the political questions into a single group of advisors. And back in the beginning, one of the very first things that this combined staff did was to work on the question or the issue of psychological warfare and the combination of propaganda on the one hand and violence on the other hand. And a example of this is NSC, which means simply National Security Council, document number 4. And what it said was that, now this was rated confidential. And those of you who are sort of government national security buffs know that a confidential document is the lowest level of government secret, and tens of thousands of government employees have access to it. And so while it is nominally, officially, and even legally a secret, quote-unquote, as a practical matter, confidential information is seen on the front page of newspapers virtually every day, and that has been the case for decades. So NSC 4 was a confidential decision that said, well, we have to set up psychological warfare operations to counter the Russians, and this will consist of what was the predecessor of the U.S. Information Agency and the early Voice of America and so on. So psychological warfare in this officially secret but really public definition was hard-hitting propaganda, was the way it was presented. And you saw it written up in those terms in U.S. News and World Report and magazines of that sort. Well, minutes after deciding on NSC 4 as a confidential decision, the National Security Council took up NSC 4A, which was a top secret decision. And a top secret classification is considerably stricter than confidential. And one of its aspects is that the very existence of a top secret decision is secret, so that no government official can legally acknowledge that a top-secret decision to do this thing or that thing has been made. Well, NSC 4A said that these little propaganda operations, USIA, the Voice of America, and so forth, would be supplemented by systematic campaigns of sabotage, guerrilla warfare, covert operations, assassination, insurgency, counterinsurgency, and so forth. and that the authority to do this at the stage of NSC4A was pretty vague. It's because the different security agencies were still arguing over who would get the brief to carry out this type of warfare. And the decision on that came about 6 months later with a decision that was called NSC 10/2. And again, your CIA buffs are probably pretty familiar with 10/2. That was created an entirely secret government agency. Its name was the Office for Policy Coordination. And the function of this entirely secret government agency was specifically to carry out these types of covert operations that I mentioned just a moment ago. That secret government agency eventually became the so-called Operations Directorate of the CIA, which has basically the same functions to this day.
One of the institutions that you mention as exemplifying this marriage of social science and warfare and propaganda is Public Opinion Quarterly, a very influential academic journal, which in many ways epitomizes this bridging of that gap.
Right. Yeah, and I would like to talk about Public Opinion Quarterly, but to get at this whole question of the interplay between the academic and the violence, I think it's necessary to take a step even further back than that, and that is to look at how mass consumer societies spread themselves, how they work. Now, we live in a mass consumer society today. I mean, you know, the thing runs on how many Fords or Toyotas or cans of Coca-Cola or whatever it is that the various manufacturers can sell to their audiences. In most of the mass media, the real job that most of the mass media is involved in is the business of selling eyeballs to advertisers, and it's all broken out rather precisely. You know, if you want to buy advertising on Seinfeld, or just to, you know, pick a show, it doesn't matter which one, 60 Minutes, the network can tell you with great precision how many million men between the ages of 16 and 25 watch this program. How many million women between the ages of 25 and 35 watch this program, and so forth and so on. And so you can see, if you watch particularly the sitcoms, you can see precisely in the advertising precisely who it's aimed at. So that what a TV station really does is not put on entertainment. Where its money comes from is in selling your eyeballs to advertisers. In order to do that, in order to make that work, there has to be ways to count how many eyeballs are being sold. There have to be ways to survey this and to put forward a plausible argument from the media side to the advertisers as to why the advertiser should come up with $1 billion a year or whatever it is to sell cosmetics, for example, or comparable numbers to sell automobiles and so on. All right. Well, where the academic field of mass communication research began was in the development of these techniques to do precisely that type of measurement. To measure how many eyeballs or how many ears in those years, because we're talking about radio when the thing originated, we're looking at particular advertisements and what impact this had on sales, and to what degree did the person reading an advertisement remember that advertisement, and so forth and so on. There are lots and lots of studies that you can find in the library that elaborate on these themes. Now, to get around to the to come around to the question of violence, what we've seen since the 1930s with the expansion of this type of consumer society, and this is, I'm not even talking about a left or right or, you know, whether one is capitalist or another is socialist or, you know, any of that stuff. I'm talking about the expansion of mass consumer society around the world. What one has seen is that type of society precludes, it overwhelms other forms of social organization. It cuts them out and proceeds rather frequently with great violence, often including genocide, particularly genocide of indigenous peoples, as it spreads around the world. As it spreads, it carries particular ideas with it, particular preconceptions about what's a good and what's bad about the world and how things work and so forth. Now, you know, we can go on for another hour about consumer societies and so on, but the point that I'm trying to get around to here is, number one, for consumer society to run, there has to be some way to measure what's being bought and sold. Number two, for it to expand, it expands only at the expense of existing societies. And number three, that as it overwhelms an existing society, say, as it arrives in Turkey or Lebanon or Egypt or in Southeast Asia or in Peru, it breaks down the existing social structure and instead substitutes itself. And this sets off a chain of both frequently damage to the people who live there and also resistance to these developments. So how do you manage the resistance to the arrival of Coca-Cola and Ford Motor Company and so forth? When the local unions, when the local social activists, when the local churches decide they've had it about up to here with what the foreign companies are trying to push onto them, how do you manage these people? Well, then that comes around to the question of psychological warfare and the whole theory of how development, quote-unquote, economic development, comes about. The main centers of communication research during the 1950s and 1960s were obsessed with this question of, well, what do you do if people in Egypt don't like the products that you're trying to sell them? What if they're restless? How do you keep them in line? The first step, of course, is that you broadcast radio programs or television programs or something that in one way or another, either in nice words or in nasty words, well, you guys better keep in line. That's the first step. And then when that doesn't work, what's the next step? Well, you've got carrots and sticks, so you have some economic development and so on. But there's also the stick. And what the stick is police and military violence, particularly counterinsurgency, particularly so-called low-intensity warfare. Methods to identify the dissidents in these various societies and to eliminate them. By the 1990s, this process of identifying and quite literally eliminating people who are seen as inconvenient to the expansion of particularly of American interests around the world, this has become high science, and you see it operating most particularly in Central and South America today.
Chris, jumping ahead to something that follows fairly logically from the discussion that we've just been engaging in, you discuss, and you write on page 53 as follows, At least a half dozen of the most important centers of U.S. communication research depended for their survival on funding from a handful of national security agencies. Their reliance on psychological warfare money was so extensive as to suggest that the crystallization of mass communication studies into a distinct scholarly field might not have come about during the 1950s without substantial military, CIA, and U.S. information agency intervention. One of the six institutions that you talk about is the Center for International Studies at MIT, and in connection with mass communication and what it does to societies, could I ask you to talk about development theory, which is actually a term which it has a mass communication research applicability and also a national security applicability?
Development theory is an interdisciplinary theory. You know, this is very much the fond dream of academics, is to have these interdisciplinary developments. It combines communication research, sociology, political science, bits and pieces of psychology, and so on. And its idea is to figure out, it's really a quite an arrogant idea, to figure out some sort of formula by which every country in the world would develop, quote-unquote, along the lines that the hegemonic power, which, in given that this particular bit of research was being done in the United States, involved the United States, along the lines that the hegemonic power wanted it to develop. Now, you know, there was a Cold War going on. The Americans weren't the only players in this game. And what happened was is that the various developing countries of the world, countries that had come out from under colonial yoke and so on, were caught in this crossfire, mainly between the Russians and the Americans, and to their great disadvantage. Even Pope John Paul II, who is no radical by any stretch of the imagination, has argued that this so-called development in the midst of the Cold War has, in truth, been extraordinarily damaging to most of the people in the world, and most particularly to the people in those countries that became centers of contention between East and West. Development theory was what the so-called best and brightest of the West attempted to work out as a sort of a general strategy, a unified field theory, so to speak, of how these types of crises were going to be managed.
One of the institutions which served to a large extent as a vehicle for the weighing and communication of some of the concepts such as development theory developed by the CENIS is the aforementioned Public Opinion Quarterly, and that publication in many ways epitomizes the crossover between psychological warfare and communication research. Could I ask you to discuss the 1952 issue on international communication research, which could perhaps be described as something of a covert operation in and of itself?
Sure. Yes, and this gets back to a question you raised earlier, which I went drifting off into another subject and didn't really get around to answering your question before. Public Opinion Quarterly is a very well-known academic journal that specializes in how public opinion is measured. And during the early 1950s, it was really rather straightforward in that it viewed itself as participating in psychological warfare. And it would publish articles describing what the various tactics of the West had been against the Germans during World War II and that sort of thing. That was on the first and sort of most obvious level. The next level, which is what I think you're getting at, Dave, is that journal itself promoted particular attitudes about what communication is, what society is, and even down to such things as what's the correct line on a strategy for dealing with the Russians or the Italians or you name it.
Right, I was thinking of some of the work that Warren Welch, for example, did in POQ.
Right, right. So the journal itself was, although it didn't present itself in these terms, as a practical matter, it was a propaganda organ, if you will. And then on the third level, what one sees is a very close inbreeding between the senior editors and the editorial board of the journal on the one hand, and the intelligence agencies on the other hand. The founder of the journal back in 1937 was a man by the name of DeWitt Poole, who was then on sabbatical from the State Department, and his specialty was anti-communist propaganda. I mean, that's what he did for a living. And moving into the post-war period, he eventually became a senior executive with the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty operations that were funded by the CIA. In that particular issue of the journal, it's a quarterly journal, so I mean, it came out four times a year. But the one that you're talking about, there were a series of interesting reports, including one that presented itself as though it were simply communication research. And the title, I'm paraphrasing the title now, this is not exactly it, but the gist of it was extremists in Iran, communication and extremists in Iran. And if you're sitting there looking at the book, Dave, you might be able to give me the exact words. Well, who were these extremists? Well, what was going on was that the Voice of America was paying a very well-known, very liberal think tank in New York called the Bureau of Applied Social Research to study dissident groups in the Middle East. And this particular study that we're discussing looked at so-called extremists in Iran. And who those people were supporters of Mohammad Mossadegh, who was at the time the leader of Iran, but he was out of favor from the West. It's because he had this extraordinary idea, shocking idea, that Iran should control its own oil resources. So now this did not go down very well with the Americans or with the British, and eventually they engineered a coup d'etat that overthrew Mossadegh and his supposed extremist followers and installed the Shah of Iran. So what you see in the academic journal, the sort of the mirror of this, as it appears in the academic literature, is a article that has lots of footnotes, and it has the vocabulary, and it has the whole sort of image of heavy academic research. But what it is in truth is a report on an applied political covert operation where these guys went out and attempted to get the lay of the land so that the coup d'etat to overthrow Mossadegh would go more smoothly.
By the way, I have the title of that article. It's Political Extremists in Iran, A Secondary Analysis of Communications Data, and that was authored by Benjamin Ringer and David Sills, and as you point out, it was simply an adjunct to an ongoing, then-ongoing covert operation against Mossadegh in Iran.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you see that same sort of, we've been talking about a three-level pattern here, where you have articles that are officially and literally about psychological warfare. Psychological warfare report on how we convinced the Japanese on Saipan to surrender in World War II. Okay? An official psychological warfare study. Then you have the next level of propaganda to social scientists to convince them to toe a particular line. And then you have this third level
where the publications of social science themselves become tools for intelligence gathering, or as illustrated in this particular case, as elements of covert operations.
You discuss also the Hook insurgency in the Philippines and similar articles that functioned in connection with that covert operation.
Right.
And some of these operations were quite bloody. Chris, we're down to the last 3 minutes or so of our interview, and I'd like to read a sentence from page 85 and then ask you to comment on the effects of some of these relationships on the methodological paradigms of communication research. On page 85, you write, "This continuity of leading theoreticians became part of a broader pattern through which the psychological warfare," unquote, "of one generation became the," quote, "international communication," unquote, "of the next." And you talk about one of the effects of the relationship between mass communication research and psychological warfare as sort of an internal purge of dissident voices, so to speak, not by the government, but by the recipients of this
mm-hmm.
government largesse
mm-hmm.
or positive feedback. And then you discuss the effects of this on the developing zeitgeist or dominant paradigm of communication research.
Right, right. And somebody who is as professional a radio personality as you are, Dave, you might be able to wrap that up in 3 minutes, but I'll tell you the truth, I cannot do it in 3 minutes. But what I will say is this, is that what one saw was in the early Cold War, they talked about psychological warfare straight up. You know, they were pretty frank about the whole thing. By the mid-1950s, they realized that if you talk about, oh, well, we're engaged in psychological warfare against the Italians, that the Italians may not like that very much, and they may take exception to it. So the rhetoric of the field began to change. And there was an example coming out of Columbia University, as I recall, in which a long bibliography of what psychological warfare was, examples of it, definitions, case studies, and so forth, had been prepared secretly during the early 50s, and then eventually published in 1955 or 1956. And the only difference between the 1953 version that was talking about psychological operations and the 1956 version was that the title had been changed. And the new title was International Communication. The rhetoric of the field was changing, but the content of the field was not changing, or at least the content of the field was developing along the same lines that it had developed earlier. And this is the way that the relatively straightforward use and discussion of psychological warfare as a form of violence and social control of the immediate post 1945 period became, starting in the 60s and in the 70s and up to the present day, became communication, international communication, even sometimes conflict resolution, and portrayed in these much more cushioned terms that tended to isolate the people who were using them from the realities of the world that they were in the process of creating.
Chris, we are at the end of our interview. Do you think it would be unfair to perhaps describe the situation that you just set forth for us as kinder, gentler psychological warfare?
Well, if you take into account that George Bush was not telling the truth when he said that he was a kinder, gentler Ronald Reagan.
That is exactly the point.
I think that was your point, and yeah, sure, I'll go with that.
All righty. We've been speaking with Christopher Simpson, the author of The Science of Coercion, subtitled Communication Research and Psychological Warfare 1945 through 1960, softcover and hardcover editions, Oxford University Press, copyright 1994. For Chris Simpson, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.